Welcome, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here and talking about this topic, which has been near and dear to my heart for several years. I'm going to talk about excellence, equality, and equity in schooling, and really talk more about kind of the measurement side. That's more what I do. I'm unashamedly quantitative, and so you'll see lots of graphs. I've spared you from equations. My first point, if we want to raise, I call it raising and leveling the bar. You want to raise that gradient up and level it, unless you're talking about a negative outcome like obesity, in which case you want to flatten it and level it. First point is we need to support surveillance that informs prevention. This is one of my most recent gradients. It's a gradient for educational attainment in reading in Canada. And the way I do these gradients now, following the OECD model of having five levels, and the other big international studies, such as the Trends in International Math and Science study, does the same thing. They have five or six levels. You saw that on Clyde's graph for the International Adult Literacy Survey as well. Going from level one up to level five or level six, there's several things I want to draw your attention to. First of all, this is reading proficiency for 15-year-olds in Canada. The y-axis is scaled to have an average of 500 for OECD countries, and then a standard deviation of 100, so about two-thirds of everyone is between 400 and 600. But if you look at the right-hand y-axis is where you see those levels. And in Canada, getting above level two is very important. It's a real basic, level two is a very basic level of literacy skills. People who don't get above level two have a very difficult time going on into any kind of post-secondary training. People who don't get above level one, and sometimes that's called literacy, but we don't like to use that term, it's just low levels of literacy skills. People who don't get above level one have a very difficult time getting any kind of employment. And then on the x-axis, I have a measure of socioeconomic status, which is scaled to have a mean of zero and a standard deviation of one for Canada in this case. So there's a number of points I want to show you. The first is the purple line is the gradient. That's the best fitting line through the model, through the data. You'll notice that it's very straight, even though it's been allowed to bend, but would bend. It doesn't bend for Canada very much. Second point is one that Clive made, is if you look at vulnerability, the kids who are at level one and lower, they cut right across the social class spectrum. There's each one of those dots represents one of the Canadian children who were in the study. And there's indeed kids from very affluent backgrounds, disproportionately more over on the left side, but certainly there are kids over on the right side as well. And even at level two, it's really cut right across the social class spectrum. If you look at so-called resilient kids, that's kids on the left side of the graph with maybe a socioeconomic status of minus one, which would be roughly where we draw the line for what we would call living in poverty in Canada, nothing like in India or somewhere like that. But if you look at the left side and you look up high, we have very few kids who get up to level four and five. All right. So that's the first point. Second point is that purple line, that's the line for 2006. The previous lines, the black one and the green one, those are going back almost a decade. And we're not moving forward, despite all the programs and efforts in early childhood and in schooling and the school reform movement and so on. We're basically stalled at that level. And what is that level? Roughly about 12% of Canadian youth at level one and lower, and about 17% at level two. So more or less 30% of Canadian youth arrive at age 15 without the basic literacy skills they need to excel in our society. So 30% do not have the adequate skills. We appear to be stalled at current levels. Vulnerability cuts across social classes. Reducing the prevalence of children living in poverty is of paramount importance, but it's not sufficient by itself. So you can imagine that even if we could completely eradicate poverty in our country, we'd still have a high percentage of vulnerable children. Here are the gradients for Canada, the OECD, and the U.S. When I did that work for the OECD that Clyde showed you with those adult literacy gradients, I had this hypothesis, which I called the hypothesis of converging gradients. And basically the argument goes that the countries that are successful are those that are good at pulling up those from poor backgrounds. In other words, achieving equity. And basically my hypothesis was around that those countries that are successful become successful because they have good interventions for people from lower social class backgrounds. I think that's true, but now I think it's also that in areas where there is low quality schooling, that the gradient also gets converged, not a proper word, but they become converging because rich people have some resources to add schooling outside of the educational system. So there's private tutoring and all of that, and homeschooling, and all the things that parents do. So there's a combination of both raising loving. You can see for Canada and the U.S. that we, kids from rich backgrounds have about the same level of skills, but kids from poor backgrounds do much worse in the U.S. Then you notice all these other gradients there that are for relatively low-income countries, not low in an international sense, but I think the World Bank would call them middle-income countries. There you see Mexico's gradient, for example. And by the way, I draw those gradients from the 5th to the 95th percentile. So the ones that stretch further over to the left are, they have much lower levels of socioeconomic status. In fact, minus 3 standard deviations down at the lower end there. So you can see huge variation among countries. So a high percentage of kids in Mexico have very low levels of skills. And the point I want to make is that if you look at countries that are successful, and you can imagine this normal distribution of reading skills, it isn't as though the distribution gets moved over. It's really that they leave more behind. In poor countries, the distribution is very skewed. So if you look at levels of performance plotted against the skewness of the distribution, it's almost a perfect relationship. Okay? Second point, use leading indicators to track progress and develop tiered interventions. I just want to say a little bit about leading versus trailing indicators. Our provincial and national monitoring systems, or things like PISA or the Trends in International Math and Science Study, provide trailing indicators that measure students' outcomes after a fixed period of schooling. These trailing indicators are important because they can be used to establish standards, assess the extent of inequalities, inform educational policy, provide a framework for basic and theoretical research, and enhance the credibility of the teaching profession. But teachers and school staff also need leading indicators that inform school policy and instructional decisions and increase student engagement and learning. The primary aim of leading indicators is to inform school policy and instructional decisions and increase student motivation. Leading indicators are data that are collected before learning occurs or as it is occurring. These indicators are usually based on shorter tests and surveys that are administered very frequently. And I'm going to tell you, when you think about the kids that Clyde was talking about, and they reach the kindergarten door, and then what happens to them from there, even though there's these sensitive periods, which I agree with, we don't want to have the message that it's all over by age 5, because it's certainly not all over by age 5. There's large variation among schools, there's large variation among children's trajectories, even when you look at how they're doing when they enter kindergarten. The most critical transition is from learning to read to reading to learn. And for most students, this occurs at about age 8 or 9 or about the end of grade 3. These are data from our National Longitudinal Survey of Children and Youth. And what I did, if you remember that first graph where I had the average set to the OECD for kids at age 15, as I set the average in our NLSCY data, I scaled it so it had the same average as the Canadian average, which happens to be 534, a little bit above the OECD average, and the same standard deviation. I said, well, how do kids get there? Because with our longitudinal data, we have math scores that you can follow as kids are going through, right? Then what I did is I took the reading scores of children at age 8 and 9, and I said, what do their trajectories look like? Well, when you look at that red line, those are the kids who are in the bottom 20th percentile in their reading skills at age 8 or 9. Basically, they're done for. They remain on very low trajectories all the way through their schooling career. The correlation between reading scores at age 8 or 9 and later mathematics skills, science skills, reading skills, and so on, at least for mathematics, it's 0.81, but it's also high for other things. Low reading skills at the end of age 8 or 9 is also predictive of things like depression and anxiety, self-esteem, and so on. The thing is, because I use this expression, I didn't invent it, I'm not sure where it comes from, someone can tell me, I'll be happy to know, expression from learning to read to reading to learn, because after grade 3, it becomes all about learning stuff, right? You got to learn subject matter. Science comes on board more seriously, and geography, and history, and so on. And if kids don't have a mastery of reading, then they just kind of mull through the middle years and then become disaffected by the time they get high school, and it comes out in all kinds of bad ways. In New Brunswick, we've launched this early years evaluation. It's now being used elsewhere in the country. It's been used in Dominican and Jordan as well. It's an individually administered direct measure of the developmental outcomes of children aged 3 to 6. It assesses skills in the usual domains. That these domains are pretty well fixed now by UNICEF: awareness of self and environment, cognitive skills, language and communication, gross and fine motor development. And we measure skills, very specific skills, like being able to recognize words that rhyme, name some letters, and so on. So we actually, in New Brunswick, we've trained some 170 people, most of them are retired kindergarten grade 1 teachers, who actually sit down with the child and do an assessment. It takes about 30 minutes. Kids love doing it. And we actually give a report back to the parents and, you know, to the kindergarten teacher as well, where we identify kids in a, just like with the PISA data, red, yellow, and green, with roughly 20% in the red, well, it's more like about 15% in red and about 20% in the yellow region. Those are kids that need an intervention. Okay? And so that's what the school districts now are doing. They've appointed transition to school coordinators, and they're putting in place very specific interventions to try to get those kids on track early. So this is all happening right before the kids enter kindergarten. Third point, support innovations that change the drivers of learning and wellness. It's all good to have these monitoring programs and assessment programs, but unless you actually do something, it's all for naught. You really need to focus on prevention, intervention, and innovation. In working with the OECD on PISA and various other studies, we developed this model of learning and wellness, and it really goes back to work of Carroll, and then Bob Slavin modified it, and we have kind of our own version of it. We say that learning and wellness are a function of quality instruction, productive engagement, enabling context, and learning time. And so if anyone ever comes to me and said, well, gee, I think single-sex schooling is the way to go. We shouldn't have boys and girls together in middle school or in high school. I put this lens on immediately, and I say, well, are you going to actually change quality of instruction? Are you going to change students' engagement? Well, maybe, then, but what's the evidence of that? Are you going to change the context to make it more enabling? Maybe, but then let's look at that. Are you going to change learning time? Probably not. So I really look at it from that lens. There it is there. And we've got these drivers broken down in various bits, talking about quality instruction, productive engagement, enabling context, and learning time. And you can see some of the aspects of those. To me, when I think about innovation then, I think we can, remember in that first graph I showed you that we're stalled, right? I think we're stalled, and I don't think, even though this was the first 15, 20 years of my career measuring classroom and school climate, I don't think we can really get there by pushing a little bit on improving disciplinary climate or pushing a little bit over here on this. You need some real fundamental structural innovations. And I'll just give you one example, the professional development of teachers. Teachers in this country receive one course on how to instruct reading. If you go to kindergarten to grade 3, teacher, one course, 39 hours. My mechanic who fixes my car has more hours training on how to fix my car. So we really need to look at some of those fundamental structural features. Why do we have 50-minute periods for high school students? Most adults don't learn in 50-minute little increments. I think you really need to get personal with data. These are data from PISA for Brazil. And this graph is fascinating because a lot of debate about rural and public and private schools. The World Bank's model is really we just need to get all schools to be private and they would all do well. But if you look at the schools that are the private schools, they're just a group in and of themselves serving kids from relatively elite backgrounds. And then you look at the public and the private schools. Two points I want to make. First of all, there's very little difference between the urban public and the rural public. But also, look at the huge range in skills, albeit that a lot of them are still, on average, below level two. There's still a huge variation. Enough to say, then, that you've got the same kids with same social class backgrounds coming into a school. If you look at kids at, say, minus one, which would be Canada's poverty line, there's still this huge variation in school performance. What we do then is we look at some of those drivers of learning and wellness, and we look at the distribution of those. How are those correlated with socioeconomic status? Because really equity is about fairness. It's our people from different backgrounds getting the same goodies. And so we're quite interested in whether those poorer schools, those on the real far left of the graph, are getting the same levels of things like quality instruction, accountability, curriculum coverage, and so on. And really, you need to look at that at different levels. I've mentioned the school level, but you need this mix of encouragement and support at the top and capacity and will at the next level. Courage and support, capacity and will. You need to look at different outcomes. This is a graph showing a change in depression between males and females in Canada. Girls have much higher prevalence of depression during the middle school and high school years. And then look at this one. This is for immigrants and non-immigrants. Generally, immigrants have better health outcomes than non-immigrants, especially after they first arrive in Canada. But look at during those high school years, huge peak in depression. We've been really interested in measuring engagement, which is the extent to which students identify with and value schooling outcomes and participate in academic and non-academic activities. Engagement is related to academic achievement, but we also consider it an important outcome in its own right. Why? Because it embodies a disposition towards learning, working with others, and functioning in a social institution. In the OECD study that Jody mentioned, we really focused on what you could call social engagement and academic engagement. And about 5 years ago, we set up a monitoring program, an evaluation system in Canada to start measuring student engagement, health and wellness, and those drivers of learning. This year we'll have over 100,000 students involved in our Tell Them From Me system. We've got a number here in Quebec of schools involved. But with the encouragement of the Canadian Education Association, we're actually pushing that much closer to the classroom and looking at intellectual engagement with a study called What'd You Do in School Today, which is about 30,000 of our 100,000 students across the country that are doing this survey. By intellectual engagement, we mean that time when kids make a really serious psychological investment in what they're learning. When I look at my own kids, my oldest right now is age 14, just started high school. You could say she does schooling, but she doesn't really get engaged. She's not really excited about what she's learning. So we've been working with this model by Csikszentmihalyi, looking at the extent to which kids feel challenged in their classes and compared with their levels of actual skills. And basically, if you look at the low skills, high challenge, those are kids, they're part of that 30% of the bottom. Remember I said 12 plus 17, almost 30% of kids with low skills. Most of those who feel overly challenged and suffer anxiety, the prevalence of anxiety in that group is over 3 times the average. Then you've got low skills, low challenge, a sense of apathy. But look at about a third of kids have a sense of boredom in their school. And incidentally, if I were cloned, this report is being released in Edmonton almost while I speak right now. Penny Milton is there releasing this report. So it'll be up on the website for Canadian Education Association, I think, later today. So, again, where I think the if you want to talk about equity, you got to focus on those drivers of learning and wellness, quality instruction, productive engagement, and so on, and you've got to think about what it is that you're going to change structurally, because I don't think we can get there just tinkering around the edges. So there's a model by an economist named Diebenstein who talks about things like setting clear objectives, accessing information efficiently. And to me, that's where the discussion has to happen between that bottom block, the red one and the orange one, and between the orange one and the green one. That's where the focus of any discussion about equity has to happen. What are we going to really change in a radical way to bring about a change in the drivers of learning and wellness? So, to conclude, prevention, intervention, and innovation are the building blocks of equity. I think equity, usually we talk about it in terms of fairness, people having equal opportunity or equal access. I think we need to reconceive equity and start thinking of it as it requiring opportunities based on children's needs. So not necessarily equal for everyone, but unequal, giving kids who come to school with poorer skills better opportunities. Thank you.